beginning a series. This was a special request by my friend Nancy. And last Sunday, Nancy said, "You know, Bert, I think it's been a long time and there's been enough new people in the church that you should go back and teach on creation." And I left church, and I'm talking to Pastor about it in the car on the way home, and I said, "I don't know, I think I just did that." And he said, "Well, I remember you did it down at the old church." I said, no, I know I've done it here. I feel like I've just done it." So I called Jack the next day, and I said, "Jack, can you find out when I did this teaching?" So, you know, Jack had to go upstairs into the attic, back into the vault, you know, he's back there, he's going through CDs, and I'm kidding. It's all recorded. And, but actually, we were both surprised when we discovered that I did this in 2012. So, if you haven't been here since 2012, you've never heard this. And it's still something that I think is very timely. Darn that Anthony left that spirit up here. You know what? Seriously? Because Timmy ran into that on Wednesday. I'm not kidding. He, like, left it. Okay. We are going to begin at the beginning, of course. And we're going to talk about the book of Genesis. And, you know, it's amazing, but the book of Genesis is probably the most controversial book in the entire Bible. And you can understand why. Because the history of mankind begins in the book of Genesis. And scientifically, it's extremely controversial. It makes one of the most controversial scientific statements that's ever made. In the beginning, God. Okay? Now, this is a question that people have been asking themselves for years. Was it intelligent, purposeful design? Or was it random chance? Is it possible for natural and mechanical forces to operate without purpose or reason? The answer that we each settle upon has a lot more implications than merely giving you a side to take on debates when this comes up, or in discussions about creation versus evolution. The side we take has spiritual implications on our lifestyle and our priorities and our eternal future. Now, science has worked to disprove creation. We all know that. But what you might not have realized is that they had an underlying motive to this. And their underlying motive wasn't just to set those silly people who believe in creation straight. I think you've all heard of Aldous Huxley. He was an extremely influential writer who helped establish the theory of evolution. But in one of his writings, he said this, I'm going to read it verbatim. "I had motives for not wanting the world to have meaning." He had motives for it. "For myself, as no doubt for most of my contemporaries, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation from a system of morality." You kind of get the point here.
Yeah.
Okay? If you believe in creation, you believe in a creator. If you believe in the creator, it's going to definitely, or at least it should, affect your thoughts and your actions and your whole life. However, if you truly believe that all of this happened by chance, there's no purpose behind it, it just randomly happened, well then, do you have anyone to be accountable to?
Come on, perfect.
You have no one. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about, oh, I'm accountable to the creator of the universe. And when I started looking back over this to teach it today, I thought, you know, I'm just really curious about now, 2016, 2017, how many scientists actually still believe in the theory of evolution? And I've got some interesting statistics. And things have been changing, by the way. I thought this was interesting. You guys all remember Bill Nye?
Yes.
Bill Nye, the science guy, right? He was supposed to, didn't he do a program for kids to watch? Bill Nye, the science guy. Don't ever let your kids watch it again. I don't even know if he's still on. Okay? Bill Nye did an entire video presentation, and this is the title of it. Creationism is not appropriate for children. This is Bill Nye, the science guy. You know? Seriously, that's like having Big Bird. Start saying on the program, you know, things that are contrary to the Bible. But the fact of the matter is that in the year 2009, okay, that's not all that long ago, 97% of scientists believed in evolution. 97%. That's a lot of people. Well, recently, within the last couple of years, however, there have been a huge influx of books being written refuting evolution. Now, I'm not saying that every single one of the books that refutes evolution does so based on a Christian perspective. There are a lot of scientists who have turned their back on evolution, not because they suddenly believe that there was a creator, but because they simply cannot see how scientific facts can prove evolution. So they've turned their back on it based on scientific facts. Now, of course, there are others who've turned their backs on it for spiritual reasons. But they, in all of their study, have come to the conclusion evolution just doesn't fit with established scientific fact. We're going to talk about that later. I actually came across a list of scientists that do not believe in evolution. Whether for religious or scientific reasons, it doesn't matter. I didn't get the entire list because there's like hundreds, okay? I glanced back over the list, and I was kind of interested to see, now these people are dead, but I didn't know most of the people on the list, by the way. Just so you know. Now, have those been authors, I would have recognized them. But I'm going down this list going, nah, nah, nah. But then I'd get to like Sir Isaac Newton. Oh, yeah, I got him. I know him. You know, Sir Isaac Newton, there would be one or two along the way that I would recognize who did not believe in the theory of evolution. And one person said, there's actually far more scientists than have ever come out and said it publicly. And I thought this was interesting because it reminded me a lot of what's gone on in the last year or so. They said, a lot of scientists absolutely don't believe in evolution, but they don't want to say it out loud because they will be persecuted by their colleagues. Isn't that interesting? They don't believe in evolution, but they don't want their name to be mentioned because they'll get persecution from their colleagues. People don't change. Okay, well, scientists in these areas, okay, are seeing more of a change, more people coming around to the idea of creationism. Geology, which makes a lot of sense, okay? Paleontology, every time I hear that, I think of Ross. Embryology, and comparative anatomy. They're no longer in the grip of evolutionary theory. I found this interesting, though. The mainstream of molecular biology majors and zoologists are still in the grip. They have serious supporters for evolution. Isn't that interesting? In 1997, a survey of leading American scientists revealed that the widespread atheism of scientists in past decades has given way to a growing number of top scientists who have encountered compelling evidence in their own fields, whatever they happen to be, of research to convince them that there had to be an intelligent designer of the universe. Now, these are scientists that are atheists, and they're researching to prove whatever area it is they're studying, and in the process, they've come to the conclusion that there had to have been an intelligent designer of the universe. An agnostic scientist, his name's Dr. Robert Jastrow, recently wrote this: "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself up over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." Another mathematician and physicist wrote this: "When I began my career some 20 years ago, I was a convinced atheist. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that one day I would be writing a book to show that the central claims of Judeo-Christian theology are in fact true." Yeah. And he says, "I've been forced to come to these conclusions by the logic of my own special branch of physics." So in the process of studying his branch of science as an atheist, okay, as he did more and more research, he kept disproving the things that he had been taught and that he believed, to the point where he had to write a book about creation. Yeah. Kind of interesting. Amen. So, obviously, you know that as I do this teaching, I'm going to be explaining creation from a biblical aspect, but I'm going to be bringing some science into it. All right? And again, bear with me when we get to the science stuff. All righty? I loved school. I was one of those kids that loved school. And I really enjoyed all classes, obviously English the best, but I enjoyed all classes. But if they had to rank them, the one at the bottom would have been science. Okay? So you're going to have to bear with me. So, before we start to talk about the book, I did a little more research, just out of curiosity. And I said, you know, I want to know, how many schools are teaching evolution only in America today? My kids aren't in school anymore. I can't ask them. So I was curious, and I did some research. I had a little trouble finding some stuff, and then I finally came up with this. I thought you'd be interesting in it. Schools are in the middle of this struggle. Do you realize that? They're right smack dab in the middle of this struggle, because religious groups and religious parents are pulling in one direction, obviously. Then on the other hand, you have educators and scientists and other groups that are pulling in the other direction. And the schools are right smack dab in the middle of it. And obviously, you know, in most cases, when there's a battle, somebody mentions the separation of church and state, which, by the way, has nothing to do with this, but that's okay. It's commonly used to cite many things. There have been cases about this in the Supreme Court. The first one was in 1968, and it was Epperson versus Arkansas. Arkansas had actually passed a law that forbade the teaching of evolution. Yay, Arkansas! Right? But you know, somebody's going to come along. So this Epperson person was a public school teacher. He sued the state, saying that the law forbidding the teaching of evolution was a violation of his First Amendment rights of freedom of speech. The court upheld his position. Another court in 1982, McLean versus Arkansas, frequently cited that that particular case because educators and parents had sued because of a law that required public schools to provide equal time. So see, Arkansas got around that by saying, okay, fine, they can teach evolution, but they're going to have to give equal time to creationism. People still weren't happy. So they sued again, and they won. And again, the courts based their decision on First Amendment rights, which, by the way, if that's what you're going to use, it would seem to me like if you didn't allow them to talk about creationism, you would be violating them anyway.
That's right. That's right.
But I'm not a lawyer. There have been so many cases. In Louisiana, a teacher decided they were going to teach creation alongside a teaching of evolution. And somebody found out about it and sued him. And he lost. This was a biology teacher. And they told him, no, you can't do that. You can't teach them both. Now, there are groups that are advancing the whole idea of intelligent design. This is interesting. In 2005, a local school board in Dover, Pennsylvania, voted to require teachers to read a statement about intelligent design prior to discussions of evolution. Okay, right? Yeah, the judge said, no, no, that violates the First Amendment. Can't do that. Now, we have had a few successes, although they're still fighting it in courts. In some states, the science books that they use have stickers on them now that say, oh, this is a big give, right? Evolution is a theory. Okay, it's just a theory. And there are people that are still fighting that in states, saying that that shouldn't even be it's a sticker on the front of their science books, but that's wrong for them to say that it's just a theory. So you can imagine why the whole idea of creation is one of the most controversial topics in the Bible. Now, the word Genesis itself, as you know, means beginning. And we all know that the entire Bible begins with three words.
Right.
In the beginning. This is the beginning of the account of everything except for one thing. God. It doesn't explain where God came from because God has simply always been. The Bible doesn't make any attempt to explain his existence or prove his existence. It simply says, in the beginning, God. Because he is the source of all creation.
Amen.
And you can't, I don't care what you're dealing with, you can't go back any further than the source.
You got that right.
The source of anything. Okay. Now, Moses is the author of Genesis. And of course, we all know he was not alive during most of the events of this book, okay? He came along 300 years after the events of creation. But here's the interesting thing. The book of Genesis is the foundation of the entire Bible. It really is. It's the foundation of the entire Bible, and you can see why it's the most attacked. Turn quickly to Psalm 11:3. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? In other words, this is the foundation of everything. Everything else that's in the Bible is built upon the foundation of creation. And people have been trying to disprove it forever because it's very simple. If I can prove that one point is wrong, I can cast doubt on all the points. If I can disprove one point in the Bible, and obviously I'd want to start in Genesis because it's the beginning, right? If I can make a point and prove that it's wrong, then why would you believe that every other single part of the Bible is absolutely true? If I've already proven there's one point that's wrong. So you can see why it's been so attacked and why people have done their absolute very best. Okay, let's go to Genesis because that's kind of where we're going to be for a while. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, God was. There's nothing there that says, and here's where he came from. It just says, in the beginning, God created. Now, the Hebrew word that is used for God is Elohim. E-L-O-H-I-M. Elohim is actually a plural word in Hebrew. So this is the first time, even in the very first verse of the very first book of the Bible, the Trinity is presented immediately. Why would you use a plural form of the word if you're talking about God and God alone and God's one person, right? So we already hear about the Trinity. Now, I want you to go over to Genesis 2. And we're going to read two verses, 1 and 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. You know what that tells me? Creation was not ongoing. It didn't continue. Very clear. He finished. And on the seventh day, he rested. That's totally contrary to what evolution teaches. Because evolution tells us that this is an ongoing process, right? Isn't that how we supposedly all got here? Things have just evolved and evolved and evolved and evolved. And again, we're going to talk later on about the fact that I don't see much evolving going on anymore. And if that's true, you know. All right, let's go back. Well, actually, it might even be on the same page for you. We're going to look at verse 31 of chapter 1. And God saw everything that he made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Let's establish this right now. The original world was paradise. It was paradise. It's not now, but it was originally. Okay? And just go back up a couple of verses to verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. Man is created in God's image. He is not an animal.
That's right.
He did not come from an animal or an insect or whatever it is they try to tell you. Man was created in God's image. So let's go back to Genesis 1:1, where it talks about God creating the universe. Now, I just made a point about the fact that it was perfect. Okay? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. But as soon as you look at verse 2, you have a question. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. Now, that doesn't sound perfect to me. It sounds kind of like a big blob. It's without form. It's void, which means empty. And it's dark. Doesn't sound like paradise, does it? And it certainly doesn't sound like something God would have wanted to create. Can't see God saying, let me just make a mess here. You know, let me throw something together. So what happened? What created this problem? Well, most believe there had to have been some kind of catastrophe of immense proportions to do this. And that catastrophe must have occurred here on Earth. Okay? You with me?
Yep.
All right. Let's go to the book of Ezekiel. Okay, I'm finding the book of Ezekiel all of a sudden. Okay, there we go. All right. Okay, we're going to look at Ezekiel 28. And you understand that the Bible is not chronological, okay? And so, you know, sometimes, you know, here I am in Genesis, over here in the beginning of the book, and now all of a sudden I'm here in Ezekiel, which is like way past almost the end of the Old Testament, not really, but close, all right? And I'm talking about something that happened actually back during the time we just talked about. All right, so we're looking at Ezekiel 28, and we're looking at verses 14 and 15. Okay. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created until iniquity was found in thee. And of course, we're talking about Satan, who had been an angel. Perfect creation, says right here. I can't imagine God making anything that's not perfect. It's a perfect creation. But what happened? Well, you all know the story. Satan was willful and arrogant and frankly didn't like the fact that God was above him. We went back and read the story, which I'm not going to. You'd find there's five things he says that all begin with the words, I will. I will. He wanted to exalt himself to a point where he was above God. And I think you all know what happens to him, right? Yep. Well, just in case, let's go to Isaiah 14. All right, verses 12 to 14. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Wow. He fell. All you have to do is go back to the first verse I read in 12, chapter, verse 12. How art thou fallen? He fell. Yep. Okay, let's go back to Ezekiel. Chapter 28. We're going to read 14, 15, 17, and 18. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created until iniquity was found in thee. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings that they may behold thee hence. Thou hast defiled thy sanctuaries by the multitude of thine iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. It shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes. Where? Upon the earth. In the sight of all them that behold thee. God didn't do this in heaven. It says right here, I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth. So Satan and a third of all the angels got thrown out of heaven. But that wasn't it. That wasn't all of it. Because God says right here what he's going to do to him. So he didn't simply say, all right, leave. He does something to him on the earth. Something that I'm certain is extremely catastrophic, which most people believe is what caused the earth to go from being perfect to dark and without form and void. Okay, now let's turn to Jeremiah 4. So we can just establish a few things here. Starting at verse 23. one more page. All right. I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens were fled. There is a theory that there appears to be a lot of people hold to it, and it seems to make absolutely perfect sense. Now, you have all heard about the flood and Noah. That's one of the, that's a Bible story kids hear about. But there's strong evidence to fact that there was a pre-Adamic flood. That means before Adam was even created. And there is verification of two floods in the book of Genesis. Okay? So let's go to 2 Peter for a moment. Chapter 3. Verse 5. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. But the heavens and the earth which are now by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day. It talks about the world being overflowed with water. There's a distinction between the chaos of the pre-Adamic flood and the world now. The first flood, the pre-Adamic flood, the catastrophe that occurred when Satan was thrown out of heaven, everything was destroyed. Mm-hmm. Everything. It was without form, and it was void, and it was a big black blob. Right? This can't be talking about that flood. I mean, Noah's flood. You know why? Because we all know that when the second flood came, Noah and his family and two of every animal survived. Mm-hmm. We also know that when the waters eventually did recede, that the earth was still there. Yep. There was vegetation. It was not a big black blob. It was pretty much the earth that we know now. So there's no other way to look at it than to say that there were two floods. Now, in the beginning, back in Genesis 1:1, God now took existing materials to reform the earth. I mean, go back to Genesis 1:1. If he started from scratch, there would be no such thing as he looked upon the face of the earth, where it all begins here. He wouldn't say that because there wouldn't be anything to look at yet until he created it. Literally. It may have been a big old black blob, but it was there. If he hadn't already created it, there'd be nothing. So he took existing materials to reform the earth. In verse 1, we are talking about his original creation of the earth. This is when he created it out of nothing. In verse 2, We're talking about him reforming the earth out of the materials that are left in this big black blob. So we could say that there was a catastrophe, more than likely, the fall of Lucifer and the angels, that fits right in here in that teeny tiny little space between verse 1 and verse 2. So don't get confused. Don't think that one just runs right into two, because it doesn't. And that is where we're going to stop for today.